Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vince Emanuele. He's a writer, activist, and combat veteran who currently lives in Michigan City, Indiana, where he and Sergio Kurchergan run a community cultural space called PARC, PARC, Politics, Arts, Roots, Culture. In 2006, Vince refused a third deployment to Iraq, left the United States Marine Corps, and joined the anti-war movement, working with anti-war military veterans and activists around the globe, including Iraqi and Afghan refugees. Since then, he has spent the past 14 years working with a wide range of left-wing political movements, including labor campaigns, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, local environmental campaigns, and Standing Rock Occupation, anti-prison campaigns, cultural projects, and the Bernie 2020 campaign. So, first, Vince, thank you for all your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks for your work, and thanks for having me, Derek.
And thank you for your friendship, too.
Same.
So the other night, the other day, you wrote to me, and you wrote something that I think a lot of people are feeling, and I thought that you would be the perfect person to discuss those feelings and those processes. So here's what you wrote me the other day. The system will collapse, and we need to decide what that collapse looks like. There's no hope for taking over the state and federal taking over the state at the federal level. The left is too small, disorganized, lacking the killer instinct and the collective vision necessary to take power and use that power to dismantle the system. The people I speak to just want what we have, but without crippling debt. Basically the 1950s, but with robots doing the crap work. I've dedicated my entire adult life to this work, and I feel like I've accomplished absolutely nothing. And this is one reason I wanted to talk to you about this, is I think so many people feel this. Anyway, at some level, I know that's untrue, but I'm sure others feel the same. I'm not depressed or anything like that. I'm down for action. We've been active since this thing started. I'm fired up and ready to go. I'm not finding that to be the dominant attitude among the people I know, but I've had more people reach out to me than ever before. Everyone wants to talk to Sergio and me because they think we have some sort of special insight into what it's like to live in a collapsing society, and to some degree we do. But we tell people, you need to be mentally, physically, and spiritually training for this every damn day, because this is nothing compared – what's currently happening is nothing compared to what's coming. Everyone wants to believe that what's happening isn't happening, but it's happening. We really do live in a very immature society and culture. The whole thing is beyond absurd and frustrating. So take that anywhere you want. I think so many people can relate to that, and I hope that during the next 45 to 48 minutes we can – come up with something that is helpful to somebody.
Well, I think like a lot of people who get involved with left-wing political movements, I've been trying to find, I think, where exactly I sit within that broader movement. You know, I've never identified as a socialist, a communist, or an anarchist. I do appreciate, you know, elements of those philosophical and political traditions, but I've never really found one particular ideology that encapsulates what is really an ever-changing worldview. And so, I mean, for me, on a very personal level, the point is to constantly grow. I consider myself sort of a lifelong student. I barely graduated high school. I dropped out of university. I'm not smart by any means, at least in the traditional sense. But, you know, I like to read a lot. I ask a lot of questions, and I find people like yourself and others who can help me answer those questions. And I think, honestly, your work has been one of the primary influences on my life. And as you know, because I've told you in the past, you know, I found your book Endgame Volume 1, I think back in, 2010. And then soon after, you and I conducted a series of interviews, and we eventually brought you out to Northwest Indiana to give a talk. And during that time, I was stepping down from the board of directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW. After really dedicating the previous 6 years of my life from 2005 to 2011 to the anti-war movement, which was largely unsuccessful. But those experiences definitely taught me a lot about organizing, mostly what not to do, which is probably a discussion maybe for a whole nother interview, but we can get into some of that today. But in any case, around, I would say, 2011, I started doing a radio program full time. And I was working with local political organizations. I ended up writing for Telesur English, which is a media entity based out of Latin America. And that allowed me to remain focused on U.S. empire and militarism. And then in 2016, I attended the Standing Rock protests with thousands of other veterans. I came home and opened a community cultural center, park, as you mentioned, here in Michigan City, Indiana. And the goal was to use this space as an organizing and social space, as an organizing hub and really a social space. So where people could connect and interact with each other on a very human level. In other words, the goal was to get people to stop living sort of two-dimensional lives, constantly behind a screen, interacting, watching a screen, clicking on screens, sharing, and so forth. So, I mean, one way of putting this is that the United States lacks communities. You know, the other day, actually, my friend Rob Johnson said that Margaret Thatcher was wrong about the UK, but correct about the US when she said that there's no such thing as a society. I think Rob's point is actually true. In the US, we don't have a society and we largely lack communities. And so our communities have been devastated where I live, first through the process of colonization and industrialization. Then I would say by deindustrialization through neoliberalism and the war on drugs. So you have first this process of colonization, the destruction of indigenous communities, the destruction of the local ecology to spark that process of industrialization, which then brings thousands of jobs to our region in Northwest Indiana, people moving from the South, largely black folks from the South, moving north in the Great Migration north for industrial jobs. And then the process of creating communities solely around those industries. And then when those industries leave, those communities are eviscerated. So as a result, you know, and that's neoliberalism, that's the war on drugs, which came in the process of neoliberalism, which really targeted and shattered black, brown, and poor white communities. And as a result, you know, we have neighbors who they don't really speak to each other. And if they do, it's about superficial nonsense and not really serious issues. And it's hard to build a community when all of your neighbors, for instance, the block I live on, you know, half of the people have moved in the last 6 months. Why? Because they can't afford rent and they're kicked out, or one of their spouses was sent to jail so they can't pay their rent. So this is how you destroy communities, because how are you supposed to get to know someone on your block if they're moving every 6 months? So our communities, at least where I live, are plagued by drugs and gang violence. We have shootings regularly, ecological devastation from the industries that remain, and, you know, the toxic legacies of industries who've moved abroad for cheaper labor. And what they've left in their wake has been devastation for those who remain. And many of us can't leave. So I'm taking a long path to answering this question because I want people who are listening to understand the context in which these decisions are made. You know, there's a lot of considerations that are made by different people in different contexts, and this is the context in which, you know, my considerations are being made. And so I grew up in this one of the most industrialized regions in the United States. In fact, it's one of the most industrialized regions in the world. So my worldview has largely been shaped by this context, and of course, then my experiences in the war in Iraq. So I grew up with good class politics, but I definitely didn't understand anything about patriarchy or racism or ecological devastation, and I never really had a deep connection to the land in which I lived, you know, again, largely shaped by the industrial context in which I grew up. So I started to think about how all of these things are connected over the years. And so I start out with sort of this concept of working people and a critique of capitalism, which then sort of morphs into a critique about U.S. empire through my experiences. And then eventually around 2010, when I became aware of your work, a critique of civilization itself. And I think the difficult part for me over the years has been how to apply that to the work I'm doing. So anyway, you know, I come home from the war, got involved with anti-war activism because I wanted to speak out about what the U.S. military was really doing to the people of Iraq. I didn't get involved with the anti-war movement because of what the war was doing to my brothers and sisters in the U.S. military or what was happening to the U.S. at home. I got involved because I wanted to speak out about what we were doing to the Iraqi people. And what we were doing is, you know, killing them by the hundreds of thousands, torturing people, bombing neighborhoods, killing innocent people, and watching some of my fellow Marines, you know, mutilate dead bodies and take pictures and document all of those atrocities along the way. So that process of dehumanization, both the dehumanization I experienced personally, but also the dehumanization necessary for an 18-year-old kid to fly halfway around the world and kill people, that process of dehumanization extends to the living world, really, the non-human world. And I think for me, the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed a few things. I think one, that our system is quite fragile and requires a tremendous input and participation from ordinary people. So in one way, the system can't function without the participation of ordinary human beings, workers, the poor, etc. I think another thing that I've noticed would be that even when the system is exposed for the fraud that it is, both for human beings and the living world, that people still yearn for some sort of a return to that system, which I think is quite scary. And I think the third thing is that the system is incapable of ever returning to whatever previous state it once enjoyed, and that we shouldn't want to return to that state of being because that state of being was killing the planet and killing us. Okay. So someone who's listening might ask, well, then why the hell did you work on the Bernie campaign? I think it's a decent question. I would say namely because we saw the Bernie campaign as an opportunity to connect with people, people who weren't already politicized and people who were becoming politicized around a collective political project that had, I would say, socialist undertones, meaning a critique of capitalism, however flawed that critique might be. But it was baked into that political project. And also what was baked into that political project was the notion that people must organize collectively to change power. For me, this is a key principle and very important lesson for Americans to learn in the neoliberal era, because the neoliberal era is all about hyper-individuality, hyper-materialism, and hyper-alienation as a result. But we understood the limitations of that political project, in many ways the social democratic project. I guess you could say it's almost like Bill McKibben's vision of the world. It is a human-focused vision. So not one of the Bernie supporters we met along the way had talked about significantly scaling back consumption or the need to put the living world before human beings, or in fact, any kind of discussion about the non-human world on a very deep level. And so the idea basically was to spread out the existing wealth that exists in the United States so that everyone could eventually buy a home, have kids, buy two cars, you know, electric, of course, and continue living basically how the system has been for many decades. But, you know, as I wrote to you, but with robots sort of doing the shit work and workers having a little more power, but still enjoying the fruits of sort of a hyper productive industries, you know, that exist here. And so the fact that Bernie couldn't even win the Democratic primary for me was much less a sign of how corrupt the system is. We sort of already knew that. And much more a sign of how weak, disorganized, and small the left is in this country. I mean, really, in the end, I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about DSA has, I think, 60,000 members. Most of the unions in this country are not rethinking how the world should be constructed, but basically how to live better within the current system while making some minor changes. So there's no reason to even mention the Democratic Party, obviously. And the environmental groups that do exist, as Jeff Gibbs pointed out in his excellent documentary, Planet of the Humans, they're no longer concerned with saving the planet and have instead turned into sort of lobbying firms for green technologies and Wall Street. So neighborhood groups do not exist, and where they do exist, they're small in number, and their efforts, in my experience, have been largely symbolic or focused on very small scale, like single issue campaigns. So I think, okay, let me just say this. I would say without question, a lot of people are trying their best. So I would like to recognize that right away. And they're doing so, I think, with some heavy hearts. And I do give people a lot of credit. And I respect the ordinary people who are simply organized to survive within a system that's increasingly authoritarian, decayed, so on. You know, it's hard from my perspective, it's very hard to critique some of these people. I do think, however, that we should critique union leaders, the leaders of large NGOs, political leaders, and others who've been sort of placed on this pedestal and have been guiding these movements and these institutions. They're interested in keeping their six-figure jobs. That's my experience with 350.org, Sierra Club, and all the rest. And it's not just in the environmental movement. It's with virtually every movement that I've ever been a part of. You know, they're interested in their grant money. They're interested in their endowments and all the rest of that bullshit. This sort of professional class of activists, in my opinion, has ruined a lot of organizing. They've taken all of the teeth out of our work. And so what remains is this sort of left that doesn't even have the language to describe what's wrong, as you've noted over the years, But we also are lacking this willingness to confront what's wrong. And also we lack the language to describe, I think, what needs to be done. And that's namely a revolution. And the sort of revolution I'm talking about, I think, is much different than Bernie's revolution. And so here I'm not claiming to necessarily have an answer, but I do have ideas and questions, and I think I have a good understanding of the sort of components that would be required to wage an actual revolution. So for me, this starts with an understanding that unless the system is stopped, it will continue to extract, produce, and consume until human beings or the planet is dead, or both. And so voting won't stop this, though I do support voting as a minor tactic. Lawsuits won't stop this, though I do support strategic lawsuits and legal efforts. I have good friends who are excellent lawyers. Even striking workers won't stop this. And I support striking workers and collective action against capital and concentrated forms of corporate power. I do think, however, that workers' strikes are probably the most useful of the bunch. In terms of the kind of political efforts we've seen recently, I would place that as sort of the at the top. You know, if we could get more and more workers to understand that their industries are inherently unsustainable, for instance, I think getting those workers to realize that corporations and the government can't continue to manufacture cement or steel or pump out millions of cars, whether they're electric or not, microwaves, TVs, et cetera, that really the entire capitalist economy must be stopped. And beyond that, we have to stop industrialization, and we have to have a conversation about civilization and the role it's played over time. And I think maybe some of their actions, you know, so some of these workers, I think some of their actions will stop the system from producing massive amounts of products, goods, and services, but that has to be explicitly part of the political project. And so far, I can't say that I've seen that be part of the collective organizing efforts on behalf of unions, because I've been a part of those collective organizing efforts, and we never really have the kind of conversations that go beyond workplace democracy, more rights for workers, more benefits, more wages, et cetera. You know, how do we... I see a limitation there in terms of what can be developed within those union organizing efforts if, in fact, the conversation doesn't start with what are we producing, why are we producing it, you know, this is inherently destructive. So if, for instance, I want my friends who work at local restaurants to be able to provide for their families, but I also want them to understand that they're not going to be able to work at a local restaurant for the rest of their lives, and that the local restaurant, even though it's not as destructive as, say, BP or ExxonMobil or U.S. Steel, is also quite destructive and inherently unsustainable over the long run. And I think part of what I find disingenuous about some of these collective organizing efforts in terms of workplace organizing is that I think you're really selling people wolf tickets. I think, I don't know if folks are aware of that term, but anyway, that's a term I kind of grew up with. And selling people wolf tickets is like selling them BS. It's like fake tickets. People are going to be set up for a tremendous disappointment if they're being told by organizers and leaders in the movement, all you have to do is organize, democratize your workplace, get healthcare, and your life's going to be good to go in the future. That's just not the case. It's not the case for them as human beings, and it's not the case for the planet. So that's not the same thing as developing a revolutionary framework to overthrow the system or to dismantle the system. And for me, that's where the conversation starts right now. For people like yourself who've been writing about this and talking about this for decades, I give you a tremendous amount of credit. And we can get into this a little bit later. I was thinking about this earlier. I think, anyway, I'll leave that. But I give you folks a lot of credit, yourself, especially folks like Lier, Max, and others who've I've been exposed to through your work. And that's because you've been saying things, writing things, and doing things that don't put you in a favorable position on the left. It doesn't put you in a favorable position with all the powers that be or to connect with, you know, left-wing political groups and so on. But you've remained steadfast in your critique of civilization. You've remained steadfast in your defense of the living world. And I think a lot of us are just catching up. I mean, when I first started reading your work, I was 25 years old. You know, I was still very fresh and very yeah, I think fresh is the way to put it, you know, back from the war, you know, very angry, becoming politicized, trying to figure out where do I fit in this whole thing? How can I apply my experiences and my skills and my efforts to something that's going to be worthwhile? But, you know, now I'm 35 years old, and 10 years later, you know, I sit back and I look at the things that I've done over the years. I look at the movements I've been involved with. And I think the whole time, any movement, anything that I've gone to over the years, you know, I think I told you this in a casual conversation, but, you know, Sergio and I would come back from an event or a movement or an action, and, you know, we'd go up to our apartments and we'd talk, and it'd be like, well, it doesn't really get at the thing. It doesn't get to the fact that this system is going to collapse, that this system is killing the planet, and that we still haven't been able to talk about politics outside of the scope of human beings being at the very center of everything. And this moment, I think, in a lot of ways, has allowed me to step back and really, I think, re-examine where I'm coming from, re-examine what I need to be saying openly and honestly, and then how to apply that in a very real way. You know, so I think part of this, you mentioned something that I had written to you about sort of, you know, building the kind of training, the kind of discipline that's necessary. I guess, but, you know, part of what I would say is that some people call this the warrior spirit, you know, and at the end of the day, I think people like Sergio and I, and I say this with sort of no sense of irony or anything, but it's like, you know, Sergio and I we consider ourselves sort of warriors on some level. It might sound silly to some people, but it doesn't necessarily sound silly to us. And so no matter how much we try and temper that warrior spirit, it's just there. And I think the easiest way to put this is that Sergio and I have constructed our entire lives for this precise moment. You know, we don't have children, we don't have homes, and not just because we're ugly and don't have money. You know, we started on this path when we were 22 years old because at 22 years old, we saw that every major institution in this country was collapsing: the educational system, the economic system, our political institutions, our media institutions, and on a very deep level, something that matters to me, the collapse of our communities. So, you know, the existing state corporate structures are crumbling all around us, and we've seen that from day one. And that's becoming more and more apparent to more and more people as time moves along. And I think this is one of the reasons why so many people have enjoyed Gibbs's film, Planet of the Humans. And I think namely because it highlights what everyone already fucking knows, and that is that this system is going down one way or another. So we can tell ourselves all sorts of pretty little lies, as the song goes, you know, but it doesn't change the fact that the planet is being killed and that time is running out. In fact, I'm sort of tired of saying that time is running out. We're just telling people time has run out. It's out. So yeah, right now people are scared and depressed. That's at least the overall sense I get from talking with people. And I've been on the phone with people from anywhere from about 4 to 8 hours a day since the beginning of March. You know, high school friends have called, old coworkers have called. And it's the same story every time. They basically say, hey, Vince, I know we haven't spoken in a while, but I've been thinking about your work and the things you've said to me over the years. And yeah, it looks like the system really is collapsing. So, okay. So if we've come to this conclusion that things are going to collapse regardless, then let's talk about how to respond, because despair is not an option. So maybe I should end there and see if you have anything to respond. I'm just kind of firing off right now, and I had a lot of thoughts when you had reread that to me, and so I just would like for you to, or give you a second to respond. I apologize for that.
Oh no, don't apologize. This is all brilliant. I am the whole time you're talking, I'm like, this is such a great interview. So no, it's great. I have three concepts I want to bring in, if I can remember them all. One of them is that one of the things that makes it really difficult is what Lewis Mumford called the magnificent bribe. And he was asking, how is it that the authoritarian regimes of today, the really sophisticated ones like the United States, not what he would call half-baked ones, you know, the sort of, he said, you have sort of half-baked dictatorships or authoritarian systems where if you disagree with the system, then you get killed. And that's not a very efficient way to run an authoritarian system. That only works on certain segments of the population. that the really more effective way to run an authoritarian system is through bribing the vast majority or some majority, some significant percentage, let's put it that way, of the population into buying in. So basically creating a middle class where your hopes and aspirations are based upon the system, and the better the system does, the better you do. So no matter that you're only getting one little trickle down, you're still you still have access to, you know, as that other song goes, you still have your MTV and you still have your, you know, as they put it a long time ago, bread and circuses. Or, right. You know, it's not just bread and circuses, because that's really making fun of it. But instead, you know, you can raise your children and your children can get an education and your children can get better lives than you had. You know, go ahead.
Oh, no. I want to let you finish, because that just jumps into something I was already thinking about. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. So I did years ago, I did a commencement speech back in the 2000s, early 2000s. I did a commencement speech at a junior college, and I had prepared this fiery anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist speech. I was all ready for it. I had it in my hand. And then I go sit up on stage, and it was a community college primarily of first generation, the children of people, of actual immigrants. And I realized that for me to give that speech would be incredibly inappropriate, because these parents and children had worked really, and students had worked really hard in order to get a community college education so that they could get a better job. And who am I to go up and attack the whole system in the midst of their celebration? You know, we can have the conversation later chatting, but I threw my whole speech out and said, congratulations, you've done a great job. You know, congratulations on all your hard work. And then, of course, standing there, I realized that they really didn't care what I said and that they just wanted to be done with it. But the point is that my original intent had been to really disrespect the entire system, and I realized that that was inappropriate, because one of the brilliant things about the system is that it gets us to buy in. And I'm not disrespecting the people who buy in or who are trying to raise, you know, three children, single parent. It's like, don't talk to me about revolution. I got to pay the rent. And so there's that. But there's this, A, the magnificent bribe, but also contains the it consumes us. So I hope there's a little bit of sense in there. So the second thing I wanted to mention is also Robert J. Lifton's book, The Nazi Doctors. He talks about how is it that there were men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could participate in a death camp. But what he found is that a lot of the Nazi doctors who were working in death camps actually did everything they could to help the inmates. And in fact, some of the inmates would testify at Nuremberg trials about the doctors saying, hey, this guy saved my life. And they would do everything I'm not talking about Mengele, who was awful. They would do everything they could, such as hide them from selection officers. They would feed them an extra scrap of potato. They would say, this person's too tired to work, so I'm going to give them a day off. They would do everything except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the entire death camp. And right. They wouldn't question gassing them to death. So a lot of our efforts, and I first, when I was reading about that, it just slapped me in the face. This is what environmentalists, including myself, are doing. We're doing everything we can within the system to protect this or that scrap of ground that we love, except we're not questioning the system itself. And we see this with, you know, you can't in some ways blame, putting blame in quotes here, because maybe you can. Anyway, you can't really blame unions for simply trying to get people better benefits. For God's sake, they should have access to medical care.
Right.
They should not have to work. I mean, they should have access to better working conditions. So the limited goals are important. And then of course, you have the question of effectiveness, that if the Nazi doctors, if they say, hey, this whole death camp shouldn't exist, they lose their job. Some other doctor comes in who might not even protect them and give them a scrap of potato. So they think a scrap of potato is better than nothing. I mean, that just really highlights the whole problem that we're in. And by now I've forgotten the third thing I was going to say.
Well, look, One of the things I'd immediately say to that, Derek, is that I think in this context has exploded this idea, I think, for a lot of people that they're going to have anything to protect. So I think one of the things that this pandemic does for us who are seeking to get people to ask deeper questions about what is wrong is that there's increasingly less and less of the pie to protect. So as this continues and as things continue to collapse and as these systems continue to crumble, I think a lot of those dreams, and I know you've written about this in the past, you know, a lot of those dreams that are also legitimate for those individuals in those contexts, but in the broader context of killing the planet, those dreams they're not conducive with a living planet. And so I think, how would I say this? The only proper response to this situation right now, I think, is yes, there's a feeling of sadness, but I'm sort of over that feeling. Like, I've cried so much over the years, and especially in the years following the war, that I think I've like used up almost as many tears as I could possibly produce. And so at this point, I sort of operate off of a fuel of righteous anger, hopefully followed by righteous action. And so I think the only way to get people to act is to develop a vision of what's wrong and what we can do about it. And here, as I mentioned before, you always talk about this, and you always quote a friend of yours, it's like you need a proper diagnosis before you can apply a proper treatment. And so the diagnosis is that this civilization is coming to an end one way or another, so what are we going to do about it? And if your dreams and desires are wrapped up or dictated by the dominant culture, you're screwed, because those are sort of ghost dreams. They're phantoms. They no longer exist in this context. So even if you thought they were legitimate or could legitimize them within a limited context, they simply don't exist in this context, and they're not going to exist in the coming years. So in other words, if you're hoping to work your job for another 20 years with a good union, better benefits, workplace democracy, and hoping your kids will go to a university, and eventually you're going to retire, play golf, watch Netflix, you're in for a big fucking surprise. That's not going to happen. That's not even an option. So that's why it's so important in this context, I think, to speak honestly about what we're facing and what needs to be done. To answer a question that you brought up earlier as well, so like to answer this more directly, thinking about the three components that you mentioned. So mentally, people have to come to terms with collapse and the fact that most of our so-called alternatives on the left are still human-centered and lack any sort of understanding of the complexity and necessity of the living world and the role it plays, not only in our lives, but in its own way. And that's something that I've been very ignorant of over the years. I could talk to you for hours about capitalism and the history of revolutions and American history and race relations and Jim Crow and Reconstruction and U.S. Empire, but I have very, very little understanding of the natural world. That's why I turn to people like you and others who know a lot more. The one thing I've come away with from reading what I've read about ecology and the living world is that it is infinitely complex and far more complex than our little human brains can wrap our minds around. So I have a huge deference to the knowledge of the living world. And I think one of the main things I'm going to have to do over the next couple of years is sort of find a way out of this urban environment, if not permanently, then definitely for a short period of time, because I think what I need more than anything is some kind of a reconnection with the living planet. You know, the living world for most left-wing political projects takes a backseat to human needs. And of course, I'm a victim of that in many ways because I've been hostage to this industrial culture living in an industrialized area. And even in a deindustrialized area, you live with those legacies. So that's a problem. And so I think viewed through that lens, we can see the inherent limitations of something like Bernie's campaign or even union campaigns. So physically, on the physical level, I would say, you know, people need to be more disciplined because the future doesn't look like us sitting on couches and talking on Zoom. The future to me looks like mass migration, unsettled communities, and hopefully a revolutionary organizations that are out there capable of dismantling the system. Building, for me, revolutionary organizations also includes a certain level of physical training as well. And so that physical training has a few goals, I think. You know, one of them would be, let me think. I think most obviously to keep people in fighting shape, you know, ready to perform militant actions and operate in challenging climates. even more so as time moves along. I think also physical training requires a certain level of discipline, and that can help build unit cohesion, you know, something that we used to call it in the United States Marine Corps. And those activities build individual confidence, teamwork, camaraderie, solidarity, and, you know, perhaps most importantly, accountability. You know, when someone says they're going to do something, we expect them to get it done. And I think we have to stop treating activism and political organizing as a hobby. This isn't a hobby. This is a life or death situation that requires a life or death attitude. And that attitude is wholly lacking on the left, in my experience. And I think that's not with everyone, but that's largely the case. And I think one of the reasons it's lacking on the left is because the left still doesn't understand the gravity of the situation or what's on the line. I mean, think about this, Derek. If we were in a movie right now, I mean, I know you've done this with Star Wars, and I've thought about it through that scope as well. It's like, if this were a movie, everybody would know what to do at this point in the movie. We just don't understand what point in the movie we're at because most people have no idea. Like people that I talk to who are ordinary people in our neighborhoods and community, they know that things are radically wrong, but they don't quite understand that the decisions we make over the next however many years, including the very moments that we're living in right now, will dictate whether or not billions of species are able to survive or whether in fact, even human beings are able to survive. So I think another reason that mentality is lacking on the left is because we've allowed sort of a culture of mediocrity to dominate the left. And I think this culture allows people, you know, to go through the motions and to never really expect to win. In other words, it's like just being involved and being on the right side is good enough. And for me, it's not good enough. You know, I'm not here to bear witness. I'm here to win. I'm here to survive. And if I can't survive, at the very least, I want to leave behind a planet where other human beings can survive. And not just, I'm sorry, not other human beings, other beings can survive. And which really brings us to the last sort of point that I was thinking about as well, which is this sort of spiritual angle. You know, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this knows, but I'll remind you, you know, we're all going to die. And that's okay. Like, things live and things die. That's how this works. So for me, one of the most dangerous elements I've encountered on the left is also this sort of futurist bullshit about living forever, traveling to space, allowing robots to do everything. It's just totally shit-brained on an ecological level. But it's also playing a very destructive role in our movements. You know, I want to say this very clearly. You know, there will be no luxury automated space communism. You won't live forever. I won't live forever. You're going to die. I'm going to die. And we should talk about that. We should talk about that because it helps gives us perspective. And in this culture, we avoid death at every turn. And our, you know, our finite nature, I think, should humble us. And humility is really the key, I think, and especially on a spiritual level. At the end of the day, I'm nobody. You know, I'm just another human being on this planet. I'm not particularly special. Your loved ones are no more or less special than my loved ones. And to your point about a human-centered worldview, you know, our loved ones are no more better than or worth more than the natural world. And then that's the same, you know, and we're going to die. And I think, and again, that's okay. Here, just to be clear for folks, I'm not prescribing martyrdom. I'm not a religious nut. And I know this could sound strange for especially the non-religious types listening to this podcast, but, you know, I'm not arguing that life doesn't matter. In fact, I'm arguing the opposite. I'm arguing that if you really took life seriously, all life, then you would understand that your role on this planet is to humble yourself, understand our own limitations, and then respond accordingly to these injustices. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we need movements and people who are ready to go to jail. We need people who are prepared for the authorities to interrogate them. You know, we need people who are willing and capable of protecting the most vulnerable in our communities from a militarized state and a reactionary non-state actors, you know, right-wing militias and so forth. And yes, we need people who are willing to put their lives on the line to stop the planet from being killed. And as someone who's seen and experienced gross levels of violence, I don't say any of those things lightly. So I'm not pretending like I've got it all figured out. I struggle with this, as we all do, but I'm not scared to die. And I don't plan on living forever. And I want to fight, and I want to fight because I love life in all of its forms, and I hate watching the things I love being destroyed. You know, at first, those things were human beings. Over the years, that love has, I think, extended to all living beings on this planet. And that should have implications for how one responds to this current situation. And the system and everything it stands for is really the opposite of life. You know, it represents death. And so just a word on collapse that I'm thinking of real quick. And that is, you know, collapse and our experiences in the war. You know, look, Sergio and I have lived through a collapsing, or Sergio has lived through a collapsing society, the former Soviet Union. Then we both went to war at 18 years old, and since then we've lived through another collapsing society here, this time the U.S. Empire and the entire global industrial capitalist system that's collapsing. So no matter the amount of experience, collapse is still quite jarring to see and experience. That said, you know, we've been expecting these sort of societal shocks for some time. In fact, I think if you were to ask Sergio, we're both somewhat surprised that it's taken this long for the system to visibly start to crumble. And I mean visibly for most people, not, you know, some people have seen this for a long time or experienced it. So I should also probably be clear and mention that for some people, in fact, millions of people, especially poor and indigenous communities, in my opinion, this collapse will be much easier to cope with for them than it will be for middle class and upper middle class people who've, you know, become accustomed to clicking on a button and something arriving at their front door in 24 hours. You know, those people, the people whose minds are wrapped up in TV sitcoms and Amazon Prime purchases, whatever Americans are doing to distract themselves from reality, those people will have a very rough time as this situation unfolds. And so in my view, you know, the United States is completely shattered society with very little social fabric holding the country together. My expectation is that this country will balkanize at some point. My expectation is that the state will only have so much ability to control so much of the country, probably leaving, I don't know, entire regions to fend for themselves while other regions remain under sort of constant control from an authoritarian state. And even then, their systems will collapse because they require a tremendous amount of extraction, productivity, so on and so forth. And, you know, the U.S. military simply isn't capable of locking down every geographical region in the United States. Regional factions sort of already exist, and, you know, so do racial divisions as well. So even in our city, you know, the only organized entities in Michigan City are the police, drug cartels, street gangs, and biker gangs. You know, Sergio always talks about this. When the Soviet Union collapsed, if you weren't part of the corrupt state apparatus, or you weren't one of the oligarchs, or you weren't involved with organized crime, you were screwed. Those were the only entities that were organized. And, you know, in post-Soviet society, and those entities eventually took over, and now you have a Russian state that's run by corrupt bureaucrats, oligarchs, and gangsters. So unless people get organized in the U.S. and organize around revolutionary aims, this system will end up in a similar situation, though under, I think, much worse circumstances, as the planet is cooked alive, you know, ecologies are collapsing, all the rest. The people who are organized not only to fight, but also for survival, I think will have a much better chance at navigating collapse than those who are not. So yes, we need spirituality. We need people to cope with death. We need people to cope with our finite time on this planet, but we also need people who are ready to fight back with everything they've got. So I don't see myself as a shaman as much as I see myself as a warrior. And for most of my time on the left, I felt very isolated and lonely, and I've probably experienced a bit of gaslighting over the years. You know, when I would talk about this stuff in the past, people would say, well, you know, you're a combat vet with extreme PTSD, so it's not really surprising that everything looks like war to you. Or they'd say stuff like, you know, the only reason you're talking about revolution and system collapsing is because you're extremely traumatized and this is what you know. To be very honest with you, Derek, I think those statements have screwed up my ability to speak openly and honestly, because I've over the years constantly been questioning whether or not what I'm seeing and experiencing, thinking, is either primarily the result of those previous traumatic experiences or simply, you know, a proper reflection of what's actually happening in the real world. So if anything, the pandemic has reminded me that I'm not nuts. You know, I'm not just some damaged veteran who doesn't get it or who is looking for things that don't exist. I see what the hell is happening, and I'm a very small percentage of Americans who know how to operate in this context with a clear mind, open heart, and a mindset to keep fighting no matter the circumstances or consequences. And I'll just end this. I'm sorry because I keep going, but I'll just end this by saying, you know, the other day I was on the phone with my father, and I told him, I was like, Pops, you know where this ends. right? You know that I'm either going to end up dead or in jail by the time I'm your age, and probably sooner. Not because that's my goal, but because I understand that if you're doing political work effectively in the right context, that the state, the powers that be, or even right-wing elements, they respond in a certain way. And if you're effective in doing that work, you're going to be under tremendous risk. And I didn't plan on living till I'm 60, 70, 80 years old. That's just not how I view my time here. So, you know, I wasn't upset when I told him that. I wasn't like enraged or desperate. I was just telling him what I've known for my entire adult life. And that's basically that this system is going down one way or another. And I plan on fighting to the best of my ability until the day I'm dead or they capture me or throw me in jail. And I'm never going to allow them to do that. So that to me is the life of a warrior, if we really think about it. And I've gotten too fucking comfortable. This pandemic has snapped me out of it on a certain level. You know, even though I live on less than $30,000 a year, for me, that's comfortable, you know? But I'm not afraid to acknowledge that, because if we don't acknowledge what needs to change, nothing is ever going to change. So even, I don't know, the most tried and true warriors need to be reminded to act like warriors, you know? And I think that's hard to do in a culture that rewards cowardice. I think it's hard to do when the dominant forms of socialization, especially in urban areas, the ones in which I grew up and the ones in which I live, you know, it requires a certain level of acquiescence to the dominant culture, you know? And this moment has allowed me to step back, reflect, and make changes. And in my opinion, I think that's something that all of us should do, you know, from time to time. So I apologize for going too long.
Oh, this is all fantastic. We have like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left, and I'm thinking about, I'm thinking that, I'm wondering how many people in the world have, as some act of violence has been visited upon them, that their last thoughts were, I wish I would have learned how to fight, or with driving. You know, it's like if you never really learned how to drive on ice, and then you're driving on ice and your car is going to skid off a cliff. It's like, well, I wish I would have learned how to drive on ice. And the point is, well, I'm going to say one more thing too, which is that I was really excited when Arab Spring started, and I wrote some things saying, yes, yay, democracy, yay, they're all going to. And then I learned that there's a big difference between mobilization and organization, in that sort of the pro-democracy forces, like in Egypt, were able to mobilize a whole bunch of people. But who won the first round? Who won the first round was the Muslim Brotherhood, because they were better organized. And then who won the second round was the Western-backed fascists, because they were even better organized and had more money and backing. And this all reminds me of something I've said a bunch of times, that it's so silly, but it's so true. It's something on the locker room wall when I was in college, was a poster said, luck is where preparation meets opportunity. Hmm. And I guess what I'm coming back to, and I want to say another thing too, which is one of the things that's really problematical from my perspective about the bright greens or the mainstream unions, is that it's one thing, I guess, if you ignore the planet, which is not okay, but if you ignore the planet, it would be one thing for a union to organize to achieve better conditions for workers in an economy where that is possible. But there are certain lies being told, like we can have wind and solar and maintain this level of consumption and not kill the planet, or we can organize so that the members of our union will do great, except that's really, really difficult in an entire collapsing circumstance. So I guess this is a long way of saying two things. One of them is, I think we need to be honest. It's what I'm hearing you say, and this is what I've always believed. And we need to be honest about the context. And the other is that we need to organize, do the prep work now, whether the prep work is preparing ourselves physically, mentally, spiritually, communally. The time to organize a defense community is not when somebody's trying to bring down your door.
That's right. That's right. No, and that you know, the way I look at it right now, Derek, we're trying to rethink. In this context, it's extremely hard. We opened the community space, as I said, because, you know, we did not want people living two-dimensional lives. Okay, well, now everyone's, for the most part, stuck at home. And for the unfortunate workers, the essential workers who have to be out there, they're going to their workplaces. I wish them all the best in their collective organizing efforts. I think the more people who are in movement, you know, battling capital, battling corporations, that's generally a good thing because people are in motion and talking about these issues. We need, at least the way that Sergio and I look at it, we need to start developing above ground, explicitly revolutionary organizations. For the people who are out there asking, okay, what exactly does that look like? That's going to be a whole nother conversation because we don't know. You know, in your geographical location, it's going to likely look different than it's going to look here. It's going to look different in southern India than it's going to look in western Japan. But we need to be open and honest about what we're building and why we're building it. And I think we need to use some sports analogies. It's like, I played sports my whole life, and it's much like the military. Like, you train all the time, so everything becomes muscle memory. You know, you practice all the time. You throw 1,000 pitches, or you shoot 1,000 free throws, so that way when you're in a game and you get to the free throw line, it's second nature. And right now, we're not doing that. You know, I've heard you in the past talk about how permaculture could be like the breadbasket for the revolution. We have friends out there who are doing those sort of efforts, but we don't have friends out there organizing an above ground organization that's able to defend the most vulnerable in our communities from either an authoritarian state or reactionary elements. And then also an above ground organization that's either prepared to take, you know, nonviolent militant action, to, you know, monkey wrench, to shut down systems, to dismantle the infrastructure. But that organization also has to be aware that there will be underground elements, I think, in the future, especially if they're not, you know, now, that exist, that I think will take even more militant action. And so if we don't have, or more radical action, if we don't have above ground organizations talking about this, what is the issue? What are we trying to do? And who are the people trying to do it? Then when those things happen, it's not just that those of us above ground are going to be put in a compromised situation, or that our people aren't going to be trained and ready for things to really take off, but that we're also compromising the people who are out there who could be organizing to do more radical actions, because they're going to need as much support as possible from above ground organizations. And as you and I have talked about in the past, you know, I understand my place within the movement. I've been out in the public. My name's out there. I'm not going to do anything to compromise any of those collective efforts. So the best thing I can do, fortunately or unfortunately, is remain above ground, speak to this, and use my platform to the best of my ability to highlight the problems that I see, to speak as much truth as I can as I see it, and to help prepare people mentally, physically, spiritually for the kind of fight that's coming. And we need to be building armies. And whether they're small units or large units, we need to be using that language. We are in a war. We need an army. And we need our people trained and ready to fight. And I'm not scared to use that language anymore. And so I think we have to be very honest about what we're doing. And I think over the next several months, over the next several years, you know, Serge and I are going to do the best we can with what we have, where we are, to build that kind of a movement. And I think there's going to be more and more people as time goes on who see that as a viable option, and who see that maybe as their only option moving forward. So as much as people like yourself have maybe been isolated to some degree on the left, I think Gibbs Film, I think your work, I think the people who have been saying these things for a long time, I think to some degree, not that that's why you're interested in this, but I think your day's coming. Not that you give a fuck about getting an award or being on TV, if not only to be on TV to get your message out to millions of people. But I think that that's coming, that these ideas are going to become much more in the mainstream, and we should do every single thing in our power to not only make these critiques mainstream, but to make revolution and building revolutionary organizations as mainstream as possible. Because then, you know, we're going to create a context in which those more radical actors can act and not be immediately thrown under the bus by millions of Americans.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And thank you for all of your incredible work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vince Emanuele. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.